From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, the unique challenges of transitioning to adulthood while dealing with mental health issues.
This is a critical period in life where we need to move on from our families and find jobs, go to college, and depression can keep people from successfully making that transition.
The web component of Project Milwaukee focuses on how former inmates see themselves as part of the community.
I'm a father, a grandfather, a mentor, a productive member of society.
Rock drumming legend Ginger Baker returns to his jazz roots.
That's what was happening when I started playing. It was traditional jazz was what was going on in the UK.
And the overlooked history of Paul McCartney in the 1970s. Lake Effect's next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. We're into mid-June, and by now, high schoolers are all done with classes, and the seniors have graduated to whatever they're going to do next, whether it's college, military service, or entering the workforce. The transition to adulthood is frequently challenging, but it's especially tough for young adults with mental health issues, such as mood and anxiety disorders. Dr. Rachel Leonard is a clinical psychologist at Rogers Memorial Hospital and works specifically with people in that transitional period, including some with significant enough issues to warrant inpatient treatment. She's with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What is unique about challenges like depression and other mood disorders when they're found in young adults, people who are going from teenagehood to adulthood?
I find that a lot of young adults are really struggling to make that transition and gain independence. And so this is a critical period in life where we need to move on from our families and find jobs, go to college, and depression can keep people from successfully making that transition. So a lot of these individuals are stuck living at home in their parents' basement, not really working, and not really able to make that jump.
This is a challenging period even without a mood disorder probably.
Correct. Any time of transition can be really difficult for people. And then you add in that mood disorder and the challenges are compounded.
We mentioned depression. Now, what are the other kinds of disorders that you see in people who are that age?
There's a lot of different disorders you might see. Depression, other mood disorders, so things like bipolar disorder. You might see anxiety disorders getting worse at that time period as well.
Well, and you say getting worse. These are issues that are not necessarily just cropping up at this stage, I would imagine.
Correct. They can occur at almost any time. Mood disorders typically start around the age of 30, actually. But when they occur at this transitional time, they can be particularly problematic for people. And so we're trying to get them while they have the chance to still succeed and make that jump.
I was going to ask, if they're particularly challenging, are they also are young people's brains perhaps more malleable or able to go through treatment better at that age?
I think the patterns are less ingrained at that point in time, and they're also young enough where they can, if they can get past their symptoms, they can still really move on and be more successful. And so we want to catch people as early as possible.
What do we know about how prevalent issues like this are among adolescents and young adults?
They're quite prevalent. Depression tends to occur in about 1 in 10 individuals over the age of 18. Here in Wisconsin, about 8% of adults have had a major depressive episode in the past year.
You mentioned that for many of them, they might be living in their parents' basements and mm-hmm. having a hard time coping. There are also young adults who are at the point where they're about to go off to college. And I would imagine that this is a particular issue as they are going to have to cope away from what might be their normal safety net.
Correct. Yeah. So having them leave the home and have that extra responsibility with depression, sometimes they end up, not going to class and needing to drop out of school and then returning home is what we see quite a bit of.
How do you distinguish who a residential approach is appropriate for? What distinguishes a really major issue from something that that might be more easily treated in just a regular clinical setting?
Usually, someone won't come to residential treatment unless they've had numerous treatment attempts at different levels of care. So somebody who has had outpatient treatment, medication trials, maybe done an intensive outpatient or partial hospitalization program, and still has significant symptoms and impairment, then we would consider residential treatment.
Well, and so what can you tell us about the approach that goes on in a residential setting?
It's multidisciplinary, so the nice thing is we have them there all the time. We can monitor their sleeping and eating patterns and have extra incentives for them to really participate fully in the group treatment. So they complete CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
And that is a therapy that is, if well known, not necessarily universally understood. So what can you tell us about cognitive behavior therapy?
It's based on the idea that people's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are all interrelated. And so to really get at the feelings, which people come into treatment wanting to change, we work on helping them make changes in their behaviors. And we use a particular treatment called behavioral activation to help people with their depressive symptoms. It's evidence-based. There's really good research showing that this can work for people, but it's not widely found.
Well, can you give us an example of how behavioral activation works?
Sure. So as people get depressed, they tend to withdraw and isolate in response to those different negative emotions that they have. And the problem with that is that as they avoid more and more, the problems pile up. So they stop going to class or work, engaging with family and friends. So behavioral activation is really looking at how to gradually work with them to decrease that avoidance and help them engage in their lives in strategic ways.
This is not a therapy that's going to change things overnight.
Correct. And it requires a lot of work on the part of the patient as well.
Well, and along those lines, for someone who is dealing with significant depression, a lot of work is a lot of work.
Correct. And that's why we'll start with really small steps. And so if someone hasn't been able to, you know, shower consistently because of their depression, we'll work on maybe just starting with 2 times a week and then gradually moving up to 3, having them start to engage in pleasant activities again or working on their resume so they can try to find a job. But really meeting them where they're currently functioning and then having small steps that they can agree to and helping support them along the way.
Is there an issue with residential treatment being intimidating for patients?
I think so. I think it's scary for people, especially people with depression or anxiety, to think about leaving their comfort zone. You're coming and living in a new place with peers you don't know and staff 24/7. So I think it can be challenging to get people in, but really beneficial once they do.
Well, and how does the group setting affect how people are able to work through these issues?
I think the groups are really beneficial. So we have CBT groups, and then we also have group experiential therapy, art therapy, and some other skills groups built in as well. And it's really a chance for their peers to help support them, for people to see peers who maybe have been in the program longer and are doing a little bit better. And the peer environment can really help motivate people when sometimes maybe they're not responding to staff the way we would like. So it's that extra piece of motivation that I think can be really helpful.
So what is the goal for patients as they leave the program? Are they healed per se?
The goal is for them to be functioning at a level where they can participate in outpatient treatment. So the idea is not that they're completely healed. They'll likely still have quite a few symptoms to work through. But we're aiming to get them more independent and functioning at a level where that outpatient therapy and medication can be effective.
Well, and let's say that there's a young person who is heading off to college for the first time. What kind of assurance is there that once they get there, what they've gained through working through these issues in a residential setting will stay with them?
Unfortunately, there's no guarantee. That's why the outpatient follow-up treatment is really important. And so we want them to have good continuity of care after they leave the residential setting to keep working on these issues with an outpatient provider. But we'll also talk with them about relapse prevention and different things that might come up and they could struggle with to problem solve that ahead of time.
I remember speaking with somebody who was describing kind of a bell curve, if you will. The bell curve being that once you've worked through an issue the first time, the subsequent curves are more gradual and less severe. Is that at work here? Is that what's at stake? Being able to deal with these things at this point in life makes dealing with them later in life that much easier?
That's the goal. And so it's all about skill building. And so in residential treatment, if they're able to learn the skills, the CBT techniques, then in the future when they face difficulties that come up, they hopefully can look back and use those skills again so that it's not as problematic for them.
As someone who is participating in treating these young people, what is it like to see them come in and see them leave a month or 6 weeks later?
It's been very rewarding. You know, we've seen people make some pretty dramatic changes. We've had people who have gotten jobs or internships over the course of treatment as part of their work. And so it's really wonderful to see the changes that can occur over the course of that month to month and a half.
Rachel Leonard, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Leonard is a clinical psychologist at Rogers Memorial Hospital. The hospital's FOCUS program is an inpatient program for young people with mood and anxiety disorders transitioning into adulthood. WUWM's Project Milwaukee series is transitioning from radio to the internet. We'll learn about its next phase when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Since November, Lake Effect and the WUWM News Department have reported frequently on the subject of black male incarceration. Wisconsin imprisons a greater percentage of African-American males than any other state by far. We've examined the reasons for the numbers, their impact, and potential solutions. Now we're launching the final component in our reporting. It's a web-based project which launches today on Tumblr. It's called I Am More Than My Record, and it collects the stories of former inmates. I'm joined by the team that put together the Tumblr page, Lake Effect producer Stephanie Lecce, WUWM web specialist Michelle Maternowski, and news reporter Annalise Hensel. They're here to talk about what the project consists of and how it came about. Nice to see you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What is the conceit of this project? What point are you hoping to make with this part of the Project Milwaukee?
We wanted to tell stories on the web that were not necessarily represented as deeply in our on-air pieces as we wanted them to be. And that was the stories of former inmates and their family members, in particular, the struggles that they face when they come out of prison, because there are so many thousands of people that are living in the community who have served time. One thing that many of the men in that situation told us was that their record haunts them and that people see them as an inmate or see them as a felon and don't see them as anything else. So we thought that it would provide a service to the men and the community to provide a more rounded picture of who the men are, to ask them how they identify themselves.
And is there something to the idea that it's the men themselves that are telling the story as opposed to one of us telling their story?
I think so. I think that to hear something straight from the mouth of a person when you say, how do you identify yourself? I think you can get some really powerful answers. And we tried to limit the men to just a few words so we could zero in on the key descriptors that they use when they think of who they are other than their record.
Michelle, how did the project work? What did the participants have to do to be a part of it?
Well, we went out to a couple different community events with the sentence, I am more than my record, I am. And then we had a dry erase board and we had them just jot down a couple words that they would like to use to describe themselves, and then recorded short interviews, having them explain what they did to go behind bars and then how they would like people to see them.
Well, and Stephanie, what did you hear from the men? How did they self-identify?
The most common responses were things like father, grandfather, husband, really identifying themselves with their families and also with their communities. These men wanted people to know that they were still active in their communities. They were youth pastors. They were ministers, volunteers. I think they really emphasized the fact that I may have done this wrong, but now I'm back in the community and I'm really trying to make a difference. I'm trying to prevent other young men from going down the path I did, trying to prevent my own sons or daughters from going down the path I did. And that was really interesting to hear because it's not something that's usually part of the narrative of post-incarceration life.
What about for you, Annalise? What was the kind of thing that surprised you the most about what the men said?
One thing that really hit me was a sense of gratitude that, as Stephanie said, men did talk about their records and admit to wrongdoing in the past, but they were very grateful, and many people invoked the Lord and their religious beliefs and said that that their religion helped them turn their lives around. Another thing I found really striking was the wife of an inmate who we spoke with. She, although our project primarily is talking to men about how they identify themselves, a woman approached us and said, "I'd like to identify my husband and talk about him." And she described him very emotionally and in a very heartfelt manner as the love of her life, and talked about how they had known each other for decades. He's been incarcerated for 18 years, and they knew each other for a long period before that time. And she talked about how he has tried to stay active in his children's lives from behind bars by recording songs and recording stories and things for them to listen to back at home. And we know that there are people who have loved ones in prison, but to hear somebody talk about an inmate as someone who's the love of her life was just very, very powerful, and I found it to be very unexpected.
Another thing that the men often said repeatedly was, "I'm a person, I'm a person." And we had several people say that, and it was just an interesting call, I would guess, from them asking to be seen by their humanity over their records, which is kind of the genesis of the project.
What is the next step for this project? How can other people submit to be a part of it?
So now we are officially launching it at morethanmyrecord.tumblr.com, where people can see photos and audio clips of men who participated in the project. And then we're also looking for people to submit their own stories. So we have a form on that Tumblr page and also on our website for people to share their story with us and their photo.
Before we go on to the next part, let me say, first of all, Michelle, Stephanie, Annalise, thanks so much.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. Thanks.
And Stephanie, what are we going to hear next?
This is just a little montage of some of the voices that we collected, and you'll hear some of the examples that we talked about here.
Well, great. Let's hear it.
I'm a father, a grandfather, a mentor, a productive member of society.
I'm a man of God and my husband.
I'm a helper. I'm also a member of a church, and I'm a paralegal student.
He's my husband. He's my support system, my best friend. He's a father to our children, and he's just the love of my life.
I am a productive citizen because I try to help within the community. Regardless of where I come from or what I have done in my past, I choose to do different. I choose to help more than any type of hurt.
I'm an artist. I have a bachelor's degree in visual communications. And I am a founder of a prison ministry called the Table of the Saints.
I am a father, not a monster. I am a husband to my wife. I am a son to my mother. And I am somebody within the community that helps support the community, opposed to what my record would show. And I'm just more than that. I'm more than what meets the eye.
People need to know that just because I've been incarcerated, that I'm still a person. And I still could be a productive member of society. However, it's kind of hard to do it on my own. So I do need people that's been a productive member of society to give me a helping hand so I could pass on that.
My girlfriend was there, and my pastor and my church, because I was on house arrest for 7 months. And, you know, it was like prepared me for why I was going back to a familiar place. So they was all behind me, pushing me and encouraging me. And I came home, and I just knew I had to get a job. I knew I had to do something different. So when I came home, I got a job at McDonald's, the place that don't nobody want to work at. But it taught me people skills.
People need to know that you can move beyond what I've done. What I did in 2004 is not who I am today in 2014.
You know, we have children that have had to grow up without his presence, but he takes the time to record book readings for them, and you know, then he records songs, he sings to them, and he cuts out coupons and mail them home. I mean, everything that he does to help fill the void of him not being there.
Two of my sons right now are incarcerated. following the footsteps of me being a bad leader. And it kind of haunts me because I really regret that I really was a bad example, but I'm really blessed to be a better example to this day because I really had to look at myself and understand myself that, okay, this ain't where it's at. And it's a better way to go than what I was doing. It's a better way to think than how I was thinking.
You know, I love people, I love my life, and I just know that change is there. So I know if I continue to keep doing what I'm doing today, I'm going to at least change one person's life today.
The voices of people from the web component of our Project Milwaukee series, Carl Fuller, William Briggs, Charles Hampton, Troy Hawkins, Stanley Triblett, John Darrell Smith, Beverly Walker, and William Harrell. The web component of the Project Milwaukee series is now live, and you can find it at morethanmyrecord.tumblr.com, or you'll find a link from WUWM.com. Another short break now, and then we'll catch up with pioneering rock drummer Ginger Baker, who at 74 has returned to his jazz roots. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. When most people think of drummer Ginger Baker, this is the sound they hear. That's White Room by 1960s supergroup Cream with Baker on drums, Eric Clapton on guitar, and Jack Bruce on bass. These days, when you hear Ginger Baker, though, it sounds more like this. For all his fame, fortune, and notoriety, Baker is and always has been, at heart, a jazz drummer, even as ill health has made it harder for him to get around. But on the drum kit, the 74-year-old has not missed a beat. His new album, his first in 16 years, is called Why, and the tour supporting it comes to Turner Hall tomorrow night. Ahead of the Milwaukee show, Ginger Baker joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North by phone from California, and he explained what first attracted him to jazz.
When I was a young musician, there was no such thing as rock and roll.
Jazz was the popular music.
Well, that's what was happening when I started playing. There was sort of traditional jazz was what was going on in the UK.
And you listen to people like Max Roach and Art Blakey. Phenomenal drummers.
Yeah, they were all very dear friends of mine, yeah. I played with all of them, yeah.
That jazz influence is in everything that you do, and that in African drumming. And so when you put together this group, Jazz Confusion, how did it come about? I mean, what were you trying to explore with this group?
I wasn't trying to explore anything. I've been working with Abbas for a good 6 years. We've done quite a lot of things together, and when I came back to the UK, an old friend of mine, Hagar, suggested Pee Wee and Alec, and I'd not heard of either of them, really, and we arranged like a rehearsal, and it worked just like that, It just worked.
It is a great lineup. And the other thing that I love about it is that it's mostly a rhythm section. I mean, you're missing the piano, but you've got you've got Abbas on percussion, and then you've got the bass. And that's three-quarters of the group right there. And it just swings. And it's so melodic.
Yeah, it's
melodic.
Very, very rhythmic bass, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And very melodic. Too. I mean, I love his playing, and I love listening to the way you use the bass as a melodic instrument, as well as the drums and the percussion. Pee-wee playing saxophone. I mean, that's the traditional melody instrument, but you're all carrying the melody. You all take turns with it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So it really happened that fast? You guys just got together for a rehearsal and that's the group?
Yeah.
Did you go into it with the idea that an album was going to happen, or did that...
No. I've been trying to interest record companies for years, and they just weren't interested.
So what changed?
Huh?
What changed? What made them interested? How did you get this one made, then?
I don't really know, but I think they heard the band.
It's a tasty album. It's just really wonderful. I'm really quite fond of Ginger Spice. I like the whole thing, but I like Ginger Spice, and I really like Footprints, too.
Well, the tune was, I recorded it before with Ron Miles. It's a Ron Miles tune.
Mm-hmm.
And we've changed it around quite a lot. But Ron wrote the tune. That was like 16, 17 years ago.
When you sit down at the kit and you're just sort of noodling around, do you just start thinking, well, you know, here's something in 5/4. I want to see what that does. Or maybe I'm doing 12/8.
No. Things come to me. I'm sort of already got some stuff for the next album if we get to do it. But it's all in my head. And I don't really think about time signatures at all. If something feels good, we do it. To analyze something that can't be analyzed. We all just play together. We don't think about what we're playing. It just happens, you know. We all listen to each other.
Yeah, you have to have the technique, though.
To an extent, yeah. But time is much more important than technique.
When you talk about having time, is that something that you have to be born with, do you think, or can you be taught
that? Yeah, you've either got it or you haven't. All practice in the world isn't going to give someone natural time.
Is that what makes a good drummer, in your mind?
Well, if the drummer ain't got time, then he should not bother playing.
But what does make a good drummer? Obviously, the time is important. Is there anything else that is absolutely required? I mean, you're a phenomenal drummer, so I'm asking you.
Well, I don't know. I just play, man.
I have to say, I really like the sound of this album, and I like the sound of this group. Do you feel like this is one of the best groups you've played with? Because it sounds like it.
Yeah. Definitely.
And what makes them so good?
Well, just everybody's got that time thing. Also a sense of humor.
Is it the personalities of these three guys with you that just makes it work?
Yeah, they're all great to be with, to be around, yeah. They all laugh a lot, which makes up to me because I don't.
Are you permanently back in the UK now?
Well, I don't know how permanent, but I'm there at the moment.
Are you still playing polo? I know you had to get rid
no.
of you had to get rid of the horses.
No. No, I had to stop that. No, I just got to a point where I wasn't physically capable of playing, you know, as good as I wanted to. But the miracle is I can still play the drums.
You have arthritis, don't you?
Somewhat, yeah, more than somewhat. Degenerative osteoarthritis is very painful.
How has that affected the way you play the drums?
It doesn't affect the way I play the drums at all, but the traveling is what does me in, you know. The thing is a nightmare.
It's not in your hands, though, so it's not affecting that?
No, it's my spine is the main problem. My spine, my left leg's very dodgy, but I still can play with it, you know. Because I suppose because I'm sitting down, so standing around or walking is really very not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, getting old's hell. Although I suppose it's better than the alternative.
What's the alternative?
Death, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, we all got to die sometime. You know, one day I think I'll die on stage and that'll give everybody a big buzz. Dying, I don't know, it's the ultimate adventure, isn't it? It's when you find out what happens when you die.
The pain of moving and touring, and we're so glad you're coming, you know, given those realities. Do you still sit down at the kit and get excited? Do you still learn something every time you sit down and play?
Yeah, I always play something different. Something new always happens. If I reach a point where that doesn't happen, that's when I'll stop playing.
If you could change anything about the way you've made music over the last 50-some-odd years, would you change anything?
I don't know. I don't know. Hypothetical question, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Are there musicians you wish you could have played with that you didn't?
I think I'd play with all the guys I really wanted to play with, but Art Blakey and Elvin Jones, Max Roach and Bill Seaman, you know, all of them were very dear friends of mine. They accepted me, you know, as being on their level, which is very rewarding.
It would be because they were all such brilliant players. Brilliant players.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you are too.
Well, I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. When you're here on Thursday, are we hearing the new album? Is that primarily what we're going to be hearing on stage?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. I have to tell you, Turner Hall, where you're going to be playing, got really good acoustics. It's a great venue.
Okay. People will enjoy it. Everywhere we play, the people really enjoy it.
So looking forward to seeing you on stage.
Okay, well, let's hope I make it that far.
Yeah, let's hope so. I know you have to get ready to go do a sound check, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, But I can't thank you enough for taking a few minutes to talk with us and introduce yourself a little bit to Milwaukee.
Okay, you're very welcome.
And look forward to seeing you on Thursday.
All right, looking forward to seeing you too.
Thanks, Mr. Baker. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Legendary drummer Ginger Baker speaking with Lake Effect's Bonnie North from California. Ginger Baker's Jazz Confusion plays a concert tomorrow night at Turner Hall. The music we've heard throughout the interview is from Baker's latest album called Why. We'll stick with legendary rockers and talk with the author of a new biography of Paul McCartney in the 1970s when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Why?
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today is June 18th, known otherwise as Paul McCartney's 72nd birthday. It was almost a year ago when the former Beatle and his band played a triumphant concert in front of Miller Park's biggest crowd ever. That was a far cry from where McCartney was as the 1970s open. As we learn in Tom Doyle's new biography, Man on the Run, the time immediately after the Beatles' demise showed a side of Paul McCartney few people could even imagine. Doyle joins us on the line from the UK to tell us more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
Do you think people overlook the importance of Paul McCartney in the music of the 1970s?
I think they do, actually. I mean, I suppose it's one of those things that obviously the Beatles were such a huge force, you know, in popular culture, just, you know, not even just music, that I suppose when it came to the 1970s, I mean, a lot of other things had taken over. Hard rock had taken over. So, I mean, when you think back to the 1970s, I mean, it's bands like Led Zeppelin and the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac, really, that spring to mind. And I suppose it's one of the reasons, really, that I decided to write the book was because I realised that it was a period that had been generally overlooked in McCartney's career.
Well, and he really, yeah, he doesn't fit in with the hard rock, and he certainly doesn't fit in with the disco influence, really, either.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Paul in the 70s was that he was someone who had been one of the most famous people on the planet, and at the age of 27 in 1969, I mean, basically, this is where the book starts. I mean, the Beatles have split up, but it hasn't been announced. And he is plunged into this sort of depression, basically, because, I mean, he is 27 years old, and he's suddenly redundant. He has no job, but he can't announce this to the world. And I suppose that's one of the interesting things about him musically throughout that decade, is that in the 1970s, he didn't have a map, you know. I mean, who knows where this guy was going musically? And, I mean, this resulted sometimes in records that were brilliant, and then sometimes it resulted in records that were completely bizarre. But, yeah, he was kind of a man out of time. I mean, obviously, there are certain highs there that we all remember, like Band on the Run and, you know, Venus and Mars is an amazing record and stuff like that as well. But yeah, he didn't really fit in completely to the sound of the times, which I think makes for more interesting music in the long run.
Well, and there's this, I think, still a misperception 45 years later that it was Yoko Ono that drove the wedge that broke them apart. But your book makes clear that it was Alan Klein, who was set to be their manager, that was really responsible. Why was he such a dangerous influence? And how was Paul able to see that while the others weren't?
I think it's a strange one, actually, and it's funny. When you talk to Paul now, any time Alan Klein's name is mentioned, right, he just flies off on one. I mean, so even after all this time, it still enrages him to think of it. I mean, I think it was one of those ones, it's difficult. I mean, the other Beatles at that time, I mean, if you've got to think about it, there was a lot of dope around and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I think their heads were kind of clouded. And also, you've got to remember that musicians are not businessmen. That's why so many of them have been ripped off in the past. I mean, musicians are really just happy to be in the studio, on the stage, making their music. So the Beatles were never very smart in business terms. McCartney, smarter, but yet again, still a musician. You know, it was one of those things that, Alan Klein had already sort of managed to, how would you put it, pilfer, maybe, right, well, or at least, you know, subject the Rolling Stones to contracts that they would come to regret in future years. And Mick Jagger actually met with the Beatles to give them him his view of Klein, and kind of backed down when it, when he was faced with all four Beatles and said, oh, well, he's okay if you like that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think McCartney saw this coming a long way before any of the others did. And actually, even though the horrible court case happened and stuff like that, they, in later years, were to thank him for that. Because, I mean, really, you know, the Beatles catalogue, you know, would have belonged to Abco, which was Klein's company. I mean, Apple probably wouldn't have, it wouldn't exist to this day and stuff. So, I mean, McCartney made the right call, even if it was a painful one at that time.
So you mentioned the, early McCartney recordings after the Beatles. There's McCartney, and then there's Ram, which is Paul and Linda McCartney. And the reviews of those kind of ranged from not bad to not even quite mediocre.
Well, it's, I suppose it's a strange one, isn't it? You know, because the Beatles were such a high watermark that really, I mean, I remember personally, you know, I mean, I came to the Beatles, you know, I mean, I was born in 67, so I mean, I came to the Beatles really in the 70s and stuff, right? But I remember hearing McCartney and hearing Ram and thinking, well, they're not as polished and as great, they're not as accomplished, really, as the Beatles records. But then that's to do them a disservice, really. I mean, the first album, the McCartney album, is basically a home recording. Well, it is a home recording.
Right, he really made it under the radar.
Yeah, absolutely. He made it in secret at home. And he did go and book some studio time, but he booked it in North London, away from Abbey Road and the other Beatles. He booked it under another name so that everything was kept completely secret. And that one, that record really is the sound of a guy just stretching out on his own. Now, people maybe would have expected, you know, 10 golden, glittering sort of pop songs and stuff, but that's not what that album is. It's an experimental album. Whereas Ram, which he made in New York, working with session musicians, it's a completely different record. And actually, for me, and I do say this in the book, I think it's the true successor to Abbey Road, because it involves all these sort of flights of fancy. I mean, there are songs within songs. And actually, from the early 70s period, I mean, I think that is his true masterpiece, really. I mean, everybody always sees Band on the Run as being the one. But I suppose at the time, the reason it was kicked is because he was seen as being the guy who'd broken the band up. He was seen, I suppose, as being arrogant, when actually, as a, you know, as I say in the book, the opposite was true. You know, he was lacking in confidence and stuff. I suppose it was just an easy thing for critics to absolutely lay the boot in term, as we say in Scotland.
Well, and you're talking in terms of successor to Abbey Road, and I think it's Uncle Albert Admiral Halsey you point to that's especially emblematic of that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've got to think about the fact that this was a US number one, right? And this record is brilliantly bonkers, you know. I mean, it's completely, it's a very, very unusual record. I mean, possibly the most unusual US number one ever. I mean, it's a, you know, a mildly psychedelic song inspired by his Uncle Albert, right? That then goes, soars off into this coda, you know, with all these harmonies and stuff.
I had another look and I had a cup of tea and a butter pie.
Butter pie?
The butter won't melt, so I put it in the pie.
Oh, all right.
Hands across the water, water. Hands across the sky.
I mean, it's a really, really unusual record. And he made a TV special called James Paul McCartney. And there's a great clip for this, which is really, for me, redolent of the Beatles, which is just, it's this strange sort of psychedelic journey, which with this music and him impersonating sort of telephone ringing effects, and, you know, it's a very, very odd thing. But looking back at it now, which people can because it's up on YouTube, It's an amazing thing.
At the same time, he and Linda also recorded this bizarre version of Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Well, the thing is about that record, really, I mean, even these days, Paul's like, I have no idea why I made that record. So, and even the rest of the guys in the band sort of like, look, you know, he was a Beatle. We were going along with this. But at the same time, this is mad.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. Everywhere that Mary went, that lamb was sure to go. And you could hear them singing, la, 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 la.
So, I mean, I think really in Paul's head, you've got to remember that, and I suppose this is one of the sides of his character that I tried to shine a light on, you know, rather than being somebody who was supremely confident and, you know, bordering on arrogant and really self-assured and stuff. He was unsure, right? But he's also quite an eccentric guy. I mean, you usually find a lot of musicians, most musicians are pretty eccentric, but, I mean, that is never really seen in context with McCartney. But this really is, you know, in terms of his 1970s work, is kind of exhibit A when it comes to his eccentricity, because in his mind, it was from part of the strain of his songwriting that it produced sort of Yellow Submarine, Maxwell's Silver Hammer. You know, it harked back to the English music halls and was just a bit of fun.
This is really the formation of Wings, and their first album is Red Rose Speedway in 73. What did Paul find so challenging about putting together a coherent band? Because Wings goes through three different incarnations through the 70s.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he had thought originally that, you know, because obviously at that time the fashion was for the supergroup. And he had kind of thought about a supergroup. He was like, maybe I could steal John Bonham from Led Zeppelin. I could have Billy Preston on keyboards. And then I suppose it was one of those things that there's something artificial about that, isn't there? And the Beatles had grown up together and you learn how to do your thing together. So really with Wings, I think he was trying to come up with like a band of unknown musicians. Or relatively unknown. I mean, obviously, Denny Lane had been known for singing the Moody Blues and stuff like that. But, I mean, really, I mean, Denny Sywell, who's the drummer, the American drummer, who's the original drummer in Wings, he said to me, he said, look, Paul was trying to give people a glimpse of how a band is put together, which maybe, you know, you might advise him not to have done that because, I mean, it was raggedy and, you know, unformed and stuff like that. But then there's something thrilling about watching that as well. I mean, I think in general, throughout the 70s, I think the problem, I mean, I asked him, and it is in the book, I said, why could you never hold a lineup together? And he just laughed and said, musical differences, which is like the classic sort of part line. I mean, I think it's one of these things that he chose the people for the band based on their musical ability over their personality sometimes. And I think that this is where the personality clashes came. And also, you've got McCartney trying not to be the band leader sometimes, right? It's just like, hey, I'm just another guy in the band. But obviously, if you're Paul McCartney and you've been in the Beatles, this is impossible.
So if the reviews of the first three post-Beatles records were mixed, what made Band on the Run so different, do you think?
I think his back was against the wall, really. You know, like the album cover, his back was against the wall. I mean, two of the guys in Wings had left basically on the eve of the making of this album, which was in Nigeria. And so Paul had, he was faced with this choice. I mean, it's like, do I cancel these sessions or do I just go ahead, right, with me, Linda, and Denny Lane, and I'll play the drums, I'll play all the lead guitar stuff, right? And this is what he decided to do. Now, the thing is, he goes to Nigeria, and Nigeria, I mean, civil war had been a massive, massive force there only like 3 or 4 years beforehand. So this was a really quite a dangerous country. And they get there and the recording studio is kind of half built and stuff. So they're faced with real trouble trying to make this record. And I think that's what it is. I mean, like all of us, sometimes if you're forced into doing something and everything's kind of against you, sometimes that's when you do your best work. And I think that's really what happened. Also, the songs that he'd written in preparation for this record were just some of the best material that he'd written post-Beatles. And so I think this was really all these different things coming together was the reason why it was such a strong album.
How would you describe where he is today at this point in his life and career in comparison to where things leave off in the book in 1980, shortly after John Lennon's death?
Well, I think the whole of the 70s is basically McCartney trying to outrun the Beatles' legacy, right, and trying to escape that huge shadow. And I suppose the conclusion that I come to, and I suppose he came to, was that it was impossible. You were never going to be able to do that. So I think these days, obviously with the formation of his new band just after the millennium, McCartney suddenly puts lots and lots of Beatles songs into his set, as well as all the 70s, 80s, 90s stuff. And I think really what he's done is he's come to terms with his own legacy. And now he's really proud of it. You know, so you go and see him now, and he plays for like two and a half hours. And it's wall-to-wall hits. I mean, it really is incredible. And I mean, obviously at his age to be doing it is another incredible thing. So I think really that's what it is. I mean, you could say that these new shows are a bit of a victory lap, really. And I think no one can deny the fact that he deserves that.
There are obviously a lot of iconic songs that Paul wrote in that decade. But if you were going to point to one or two that might not be thought of as much today but are worth revisiting, what should we be listening to?
One of the songs that he started playing again recently is a track called Junior's Farm, right, which was the first thing that the second lineup of Wings put together. And it was written down in Nashville, on the ranch owned by this guy, Cuddly Putnam Jr., who had written things like The Green, Green Grass of Home and D-I-V-O-R-C-E, you know, so big country writer and stuff. So they go down there to try and write and get this band together and stuff. And it's a whole eventful thing which almost tears the band apart and stuff. But out of this comes this great sort of rocker, Junior's Farm, which is really a massively overlooked thing because it's almost... It's like a get back sort of nonsense rocker, you know, nonsense lyric, you know, really playful and stuff like that. But in a way, it's so joyful. You can hear him, the new guitarist, Jimmy McCulloch, is in the band at that point. And just before the guitar solo on the record, McCartney goes, "Take me down, Jimmy." Right? And it's just, you can see that he's completely enjoying himself. And he's really, really, you know, liberated, basically, is the word.
Talking to an Eskimo, said he was open for a fall of snow. Went up off the sea line, ready to go. Let's go.
Well, Tom Doyle, it's great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, mate.
Tom Doyle's new book is called Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. It just came out yesterday in time for Paul McCartney's 72nd birthday, which is today. And on the off chance you are listening, Sir Paul, happy birthday. That's the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Let's go.